we face a fascist threat that is indescribable in terms of the harm that it could do if it is able to consolidate power.
We are looking at an overall system failure now. The defensive, the last dying mechanisms of popular defense under the rubric of bourgeois democracy seem to be fading.
You cannot just simply vote fascism out. You're not going to defeat it just through an electoral strategy, and especially not through the Democrats, because they are actually, as Paul pointed out from the mission statement, that the Democrats are constantly going to reach across the aisle.
Welcome to episode 182 of the Refuse Fascism podcast, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Zam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in the United States. In today's episode, we're sharing excerpts from our recent sustainer patron-only Ask Us Anything episode with Coco Das, Refuse Fascism editorial board member and frequent guest host of this show, and Paul Street, author, historian, frequent guest of the pod, and Refuse Fascism editorial board member, along with myself. But first, thanks to everyone who goes the extra step and rates and reviews the show on Apple Podcasts, shares and comments on social media or the YouTubes. It helps us reach more listeners. And of course, we read everyone. After listening to today's show, take a sec, help grow this community, write a review, drop 5 stars wherever you listen. Subscribe, follow, so you never miss an episode. And of course, continue all that sharing and commenting on social media. Thanks to all who support the show over at Patreon. Become a patron for as little as $2 a month over at patreon.com/refusefascism. Before we get to our Q&A, we have to talk about some developments as they relate to the rising fascist threat. We're going to dig into the Supreme Court case that could shut down Trump prosecution for attempting to steal the election in our first episode in the new year. That's a few weeks away in January. But we do have a couple of things to say right now. The Supreme Court agreed this past week to hear a January 6th coup participant's appeal of a charge for quote-unquote obstruction of an official proceeding, which the DOJ has used to prosecute over 300 insurrectionists. The Supreme Court will consider the scope of a federal statute that makes it a crime for anyone who quote-unquote corruptly obstructs, influences, or impedes an official proceeding. And this is important because it has implications for key parts of Trump's federal 2020 election indictment, which charged Trump with obstruction of an official proceeding and conspiracy to obstruct. It's a novel legal strategy to get Trump off following the overall MAGA strategy of eviscerating the law itself to serve fascist ends. Proceedings in Trump's 2020 election subversion case that had been scheduled for March are paused as he appeals a decision rejecting his claims of immunity, making it more and more likely that Trump will get his wish of skating any accountability prior to elections. The Supreme Court was asked by special counsel Jack Smith to weigh one of Trump's main defenses in his 2020 election subversion cases, whether he is, quote unquote, absolutely immune from prosecution for crimes he committed in office. The Supreme Court is expected to hear oral arguments in the spring, with a ruling likely by the end of June. In abortion news, we have the same Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade taking on the case of mifepristone, one of two medications used in the most common method of abortion in the United States, a method becoming even more vital as state laws ban and restrict abortion access, shuttering clinics and threatening doctors. This is a case stemming from the most unhinged corners of the federal judiciary, where anti-abortion activists have been given judgeships and have used those positions to create cases almost out of thin air. This could restrict or even upend FDA approval of a medication proven safer than Tylenol over the course of 20 years on the market. And this restriction would be whether abortion is legal in the state or not. So it affects these quote unquote safe states. As it stands now, the Fifth Circuit's ruling to severely restrict the availability of the pill has been prevented from going into effect. But there's every reason to believe that the same fascist stacked Supreme Court, which enabled states to criminalize abortion, is ready to take this next step in dismantling women's rights. Despite the toxic, desperately rose-tinted gaslighting that dominates the so-called reproductive rights movement, the Supreme Court taking this case is not a positive step. A positive step would be millions of people pouring into the streets to demand legal abortion nationwide now. The problem is not, as some in the movement contend, legal confusion, and the solution is not circumventing unjust laws, a strategy that even many women of wealth and privilege probably won't be able to get away with in a fascist country with 21st century surveillance apparatus, let alone everyone else. The problem is criminalization, restrictions, the gutting of legal rights and protections, and a fascist movement hellbent on permanent second-class status for women and LGBTQ people. The problem is forced motherhood. The problem is female enslavement. Why should we prepare for and accommodate the further restricting of abortion access? Why should we prepare for and accept lesser quality care, stockpiling pills, and the forcing of abortion underground? The solution is to disrupt the very foundation of this country until abortion on demand and without apology is the law of the land. As it stands right now, the hearing will likely happen early next year. That's next month, January, with a decision expected in June of 2024. Mark Joseph Stern and Dahlia Lithwick wrote incisively over at Slate saying, "If a decision against the plaintiffs on standing happens, it may be only a stay of execution for mifepristone, because the plaintiffs here don't just want to criminalize medication abortion. They want to ban all abortion throughout the country." Mark and Dahlia go on to say, "For those drawing comfort in the fact that not losing at the court constitutes the new winning, there are three important cautions to keep in mind. The first is the standard warning that not losing on a baseless and indefensible lawsuit never moves the goalposts, but invariably moves the Overton window. The second is that not losing on standing, while opening up the prospect of someday losing on Comstock in a case where plaintiffs can make a credible case for standing, is a loss for abortion access nationwide. The final caution is that Dobbs itself is a disastrous loss for reproductive freedom." And they end with this essential warning: don't make the mistake of being lulled into snooze in the same year Dobbs' full viciousness is laid bare nationwide. And I want to add, don't wait for SCOTUS to decide. Raise the green bandana for abortion rights and raise hell now to demand fascist judges hands off abortion medication, legal abortion on demand and without apology. For more background on mifepristone, see the April 16th episode of this podcast featuring Mark Joseph Stern and Dr. Elizabeth Newhall. Meanwhile, we are seeing a number of cases getting some level of national attention where state courts, empowered by the overturning of the right to abortion, are actively attempting to ruin individual women's lives. In Texas, Kate Cox was forced to flee her home state to receive a termination of a non-viable pregnancy that threatened her health after Christian fascist Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, personally intervened. While this should never have been a legal question in the first place, a court had granted her access due to the medical exceptions in the law. But Paxton brought the case to the Texas Supreme Court, which chose to prevent her from getting the time-sensitive procedure pending their hearing of the case. He threatened her doctor and even contacted area hospitals to threaten them under Texas law that can imprison doctors for life for providing abortion care. After Cox acquired an abortion out of state, the Texas Supreme Court still decided the case in favor of state-enforced patriarchy. Over in Ohio, Brittany Watts is being charged over her traumatic miscarriage, which itself was made much more dangerous and painful by the restrictions placed on abortion by her state. Black women in the U.S., like Brittany, are nearly three times more likely to die during pregnancy or delivery than any other race. After being postponed and refused a medically necessary abortion to salvage her health and potentially save her life, she torturously miscarried at home and then flushed the remains, which fascists have seized on to open an investigation and charge Watts with quote-unquote abusing a corpse. Professor Grace Howard was quoted by the Associated Press saying, quote, her miscarriage was entirely ordinary. So I just want to know what the prosecutor thinks she should have done. If we are going to require people to collect and bring used menstrual products to hospitals so that they can make sure it is indeed a miscarriage, it's as ridiculous and invasive as it is cruel, end quote. These two cases represent the tip of the iceberg of the terror and violence being perpetrated on women, girls, and others seeking abortions. With the cruel denial of care at the heart of these stories, affecting tens of millions across the country, and the denial of women's humanity affecting us all. In not so unrelated news, fascism expert and previous guest of our pod, Professor Jason Stanley, is now giving advice about who should flee the country when the fascists sweep into power. In a conversation with Solange Chauncey DeVega, the pair paint a stark picture of the cruel future Trump is promising, the ever-increasing likelihood of it coming to pass, and bemoan many in the media who have refused to recognize the threat of fascism until possibly it's too late. Stanley makes the point that, quote, if you are just now realizing that Trump is a fascist, you're going to look for signs to assuage yourself that you are just being hysterical because you spent so many years calling those of us who have been correctly describing reality hysterical, end quote. This is apt, and in it, I see a challenge, an invitation to all of us, to all our listeners, too, to take refuse fascism that has consistently been raising the alarm and mobilizing to stop this nightmare since December 2016, calling on people to stop the regime before they started and then waged essential struggle, calling on people to drive out the Trump-Pence regime through sustained mass nonviolent protests to bring refused fascism to every outlet that ignored us and sidelined us for all that time and make the case for bringing us on and spreading the reach of this pod and this movement. And I think it's also a reminder for us to heed this warning and to act now. With that, some of your burning questions and some of our answers.
Thank you for being a sustainer and patron. Because of you, we can have this podcast that's going into its 180th episode. I remember when we started, we were calling it Inside Without Now. It was during the first days of the pandemic. A lot has changed, but the essence of our original analysis that Trump is a fascist and brought a fascist regime into the White House has remained true. Even more so, and we're on a very dangerous path. These essential conversations that Sam is having with people who are thinking about these questions and actually doing important research and able to inform the public in really important ways on things like Project 2025 or Mike Johnson, the new speaker. This is a part of the work that we have to do and spread of building up these networks of support, resistance, information, because things are coming to a head and we have to be prepared to act. What's called for right now is not going to be the same thing that maybe we will have to do in a few months, but it's really, really critical that this organization was allowed to continue its work through the support of people like you, and that this podcast has become an established part of talking about what's going on in this country. One thing I know for sure, and I'm looking forward to hearing Paul's opening comments, is we need to continue having these conversations and getting the tools to be able to talk to everybody we know about this fascist threat and getting people to wake up to the reality of it. With that, I'll say thank you again, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks, Coco. For those who don't know Paul, I'm sure you do if you listen to the show, but Paul is another wonderful member of the Refuse Fascism Editorial Board. He is a historian and author, and frequent guest on the pod, and I'm so glad to hear what you got to say, Paul.
You know, I really want to thank folks for supporting this remarkable podcast. I have been reviewing this podcast recently and going back, I've been finding some of the transcripts of it. This may sound sort of self-congratulatory since I'm on the editorial board, but just looking at it from outside as within sort of an academic perspective, it strikes me some of these interviews are just absolutely extraordinary. Plus, they are apparently transcribed. I wonder, Sam, if anyone's ever thought about collecting some of these, picking out some of the better interviewers and putting them together as a book, because most of it really is at that level of caliber. I want to just refresh people very quickly on, with the refuse fascism definition, which I have open on my phone right now. And I just think that's worth doing. Fascism is not just a gross combination of horrific reactionary policies. It is a qualitative change in how society is governed. Once in power, fascism's defining feature is the essential elimination of the rule of law and democratic and civil rights. Fascism foments relies on xenophobic nationalism, racism, misogyny, and the aggressive reinstitution of traditional values. Truth is obliterated. Fascist mobs and threats of violence are unleashed to build their movement, consolidate power. The Democratic Party will not stop this nightmare. The Democratic Party will consistently pull to try to work with, conciliate, and collaborate with fascists. But there can be no reconciliation with fascism except on the terms of the fascist. Fascism must be resolutely opposed. I think it's very important to go back to that. On a purely academic level, I might add a few things to that definition. For example, palingenetic ultranationalism. This sense that recurs across every form of fascism, that a great nation has been stabbed in the back and has been brought down and needs to be restored. This othering and demonizing of typically racialized others. This stabbed in the back narrative, which Trump has really been running with strong lately, that there's this nefarious international globalist, typically Jewish conspiracy that's worked its way insidiously into the inner sinews of the once great nation and is destroying it from behind. Anti-socialism and militant violent threats against Marxists and socialists and leftists and anarchists is a recurrent theme in fascism. I'm sure many here noticed that Trump recently said that when he gets back in power, even though I think we all know his main target will be the other establishment party, people with actual power. But nonetheless, this remarkable stabbed in the back language and also this incredibly chilling statement that we are going to root out the vermin, the Marxist and socialist and radical vermin from the country. One thing that I think is very interesting in the refused fascism definition from the refused fascism website, we don't say in our definition complete denial or no acknowledgement of the existence of fascism. We just say the Democrats will conciliate with and collaborate with and try and make deals with fascism. And I think that's important. There's a warning there, and I think it's an interesting sort of reminder. Don't get too excited about the fact that you're hearing the F word now more than you've ever heard it before in mainstream media. I've never heard it said on MSNBC so much in my life as I have in the last few months. It's commonplace, and it's not just Mehdi Hasan. You hear it from Chris Hayes. Rachel Maddow says it. Of course, how Rachel Maddow says fascism and what she means by it and what is to be done about it is interesting from how Refuse Fascism says fascism and what we mean by it and what we think needs to be done about it. And that might be an interesting thing to tease out. One whole wing of the ruling class, one whole entirety of the only two viable capitalist political parties in this country has been overtaken by a political philosophy that fits our definition of fascism. It's absolutely extraordinary, and it's become normalized. There's a Speaker of the House now who's openly opposed to the separation of church and state. Of course, that's one of the American characteristics of fascism, is the strong emphasis on the cross and the evangelical Christianity and all that.
I'm so glad to not only have so many sustainers and patrons on, but also to have so many great people from our podcast team. So I just wanted to make sure to shout out Lena and Richie and Mort and Deborah and Mark, who all help with the pod in some way. And Janet, who also supports as a volunteer, who helps with some of the transcriptions. could not be on, but sent some questions. And I do want to pose one of them that connects with something that Paul was just saying about MSNBC. So I'm just going to read her question and then open it up to all of you. Janet wrote, even Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes are using that F word now to describe Trump and Stephanie Miller, but they are getting more militant about voting. If you vote third party, you're voting for Trump, even retroactively. If you voted for Jill Stein, you voted for Trump. Is there any way to shut them up better than that, to get them to listen and think? I have some thoughts on it, but I'd love to hear what your response would be.
We really cannot predict how quickly things can change. And in terms of what might happen in the next few months or the next year, who would have thought that there would be all this turmoil over what's going on in Israel and Palestine? Here's the problem. Today, I was listening to the podcast, the guest. She was really interesting, and she was saying how these fascists keep their eye on the ball and they don't take their eye off that ball. And I think the problem with the Democrats and in thinking that there is an electoral solution to this is that the ball that the Democrats actually have their eye on is not the ball that most the masses of people think that they have their eye on. It is not to stop fascism. It's not to even speak up for the rights of people. It's to protect the empire. And I think there's a lot that's sort of being ripped apart right now that is sort of exposing what the Democrats are about. We don't make an assessment on whether people should vote or not. But I think that it's very clear what the last 3 years has shown us is that you cannot just simply vote fascism out. You're not going to defeat it just through an electoral strategy, and especially not through the Democrats, because they are actually, as Paul pointed out from the mission statement, that the Democrats are constantly going to reach across the aisle. And here's a perfect example. And I think this is part of what needs to be brought out to people. Everything that happened with the House Speaker fiasco, like it seemed like a fiasco, right? People were saying, you know, look at this Republican Party. They can't even agree on a House Speaker. But what actually happened was that the more lunatic wing of the party made a gamble and it paid off. And they got a House Speaker that is a rabid, frightening Christian fascist, but he's also got a respectable veneer. And you have Chuck Schumer and Biden saying they can't wait to work with him. You know, this is the dynamic, and it's so deadly. Rachel Maddow, and are they going to change their tune just because we say they should? No, but there's a combination of what we add to the discourse, what people do in the streets, and what the objective situations are, what unfolds. But we have to be ready, I think, to seize on the things that are happening, that are ripping the mask off, and really be able to bring out the reality of what's happening to people.
I just wanted to add something from a lot of unity with what you're saying, and then something that's, I'm hoping, Janet will feel like is a direct answer. I think that we got to be clear on who our audience is in the minds that we want to shift and the role that certain media plays. Look, Stephanie Miller and Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow and many others on MSNBC who are using the F word. Welcome aboard. I'm glad that they're using the F word, and I'm glad that they're providing some exposure of what that is. But ultimately, in my opinion, what they're doing is playing a role in getting people all warm and cuddly under the wing of the Democratic Party and bringing people back in. And that's the role that they serve. I do believe, as individuals, I'm sure they care very much about this fascist threat. But at best, all they are leaving people to do is to cheerlead for an opposition party that is ultimately enabling this fascism and has not in any way tempered this fascist menace back. And in fact, it can't. My big thing is to all the people that look to and hang on every word of their favorite MSNBC host when they are holding these two thoughts that are completely contradictory in their minds. The thought, on the one hand, the correct recognition that we face a fascist threat that is indescribable in terms of the harm that it could do if it is able to consolidate power, and that recognition of that world.
And at the same time that they are saying this is the biggest threat to democracy we face, telling people to rely on the institutions and mechanisms and norms that these fascists don't give a fuck about. In fact, they're hellbent on eviscerating. They are holding those two thoughts in their mind. And it is not on us to be out there arguing why our method is the right method. They should be able to walk us through how exactly this is going to work. When they're saying it's fascism, they're threatening democracy, they're going to overturn everything that we hold dear. And then they're saying, and that's why we have to vote like we've never voted before. Right after saying that this is a fascist who doesn't care about your votes, we got to be saying, okay, can you walk me through how that's going to work out? How does this work? And that's got to be put back on them. So that's just my thought on that, that I think we should do like a whole episode on. I'm putting a note there on that. It's really hard for people to think of anything but this small window of time that happens several months from now, this day in November. We've talked about it before, about this coup being ongoing, about this being a slow civil war that's speeding up with really genocidal implications. If that's the reality, then honestly, what matters is what we do right now while we're recognizing all the potentiality that exists in the future. And I don't want to be predictive. I don't want to have a conversation that is dictated by some poll results about voting or about who's winning today. Not that anyone's suggesting that we do that, but I think that in the larger sphere, they are. And we're told to view it that way. When really what we know right now is that fascism is winning. It's winning in state houses across the country. It's winning in dictating the law of the land by a SCOTUS that's packed with fascists. What we do now matters. If we want people to resist later when there is the potential of a fascist being in power who's threatening to like eliminate all of his enemies, I don't think that's a winning game. Right now, sounding the alarm isn't just sounding the alarm. It's also pulling people away from dead ends that aren't going to stop this. It's not just a shit is bad and we're going to tell you each week how bad it is, but shit is bad. And we have a role to play in fighting for this future and deciding its outcome. We have a role to play in that. Here's what's not going to work. And we know it's not going to work because we tried it. Because if we just sound the alarm and are talking about fascism, you know, exposing what's happening, people walk directly to one, they stay in this very narrow view of how we make change and they don't see the big picture. And so I think that there's a need to do, honestly, a lot of struggle with people right now.
Can I add just one brief thing, Sam?
Yeah, no, do it.
And briefly, I was just listening to you. I thought that was great. And also I saw a role in exposing the social forces that have astonishingly or sickeningly enough made fascism a major force in American political and social life, regardless of the outcome of elections. Let's say Biden comes back and somehow ekes it out and gets to the Electoral College. All that base doesn't just disappear overnight, and it's come from somewhere. It's been grown. It's been seed-bedded. And it isn't just fundamentalist Christianity either. It's a whole bunch of shit, including all the violence that is constantly broadcast across horrific telescreens by media companies that are owned by liberals. There are many forces that come together to create that. Anyway, I'm done. I just wanted to say that.
I wanted to just read, I thought that this was a really important question. Cece wrote, what about the impact of the thousands who are standing against the genocide against the Palestinians being brought into the struggle against fascist consolidation in the US?
You know, I think this is actually a huge deal and it's having a huge impact. Maybe not in terms of the numbers, it's not millions of people, but the way that they are really disrupting major parts of society, how much of a debate that it's breaking open. And it also has huge implications for what's shaping up in the electoral realm and how people are seeing the Democratic Party. I wanted to relate this back to a comment I saw about Biden being a firewall I just want to sort of toss that question back to everybody. And in thinking about what has changed since the 2020 election, that there was a very important need to stop Trump from winning that election, to stop that consolidation, to buy us more time. I actually think that's a good metaphor. Biden is a firewall. But is that the reality now? This situation in Israel-Palestine is actually exposing how, if we like keep up the metaphor, the holes, the gaps and things in this firewall. For one thing, Biden and the Democrats are, the two parts of the ruling class are united about support for Israel and what they're doing in Gaza. And two, you know, Biden is the one who has said that if there weren't an Israel, then we would have to invent it. It shows what is his primary role, and that is to prop up this empire. How much longer are we going to be able to rely on this? I think what's happening is that relying on this as a firewall is really breaking down. It's not sustainable. One, because of the determination of the fascists, and two, because there's a disconnect with reality and what people are seeing on the screen happening and what message we're getting from the Democratic Party. So I guess, you know, I just think it's very significant what's happening. It's very important that people are standing up. And I think we should learn a lot from how they're doing it and how that is resetting terms. And I think it's something that we really need to keep our eye on. But mainly, I think it's really important for us to really think about these things that we're holding on to, even while logically we might be thinking, okay, the Democrats are not an answer. Elections alone are not the answer. But how are we holding on to these ideas and hopes that the Democratic Party is going to save us? And I think the sooner that we kind of dispense with those illusions, the more we will be able to help equip people to do what they really do need to do.
I was really struck by this question from Jeremy, what held people back from mobilization on a greater scale against fascism during the Trump administration? Well, faith in elections, excessive faith in election, excessive attachment to elections, identity politics, the stories I could tell where I was shut down trying to sustain and expand actions in the streets because of the color of my skin and my gender. It's just horrifying. Localism. I saw this in Iowa City like crazy. And I also saw in Chicago this obsession with just sort of your nose in the ground of your immediate local only issues. Rampant individualism, nothing new, depression, sickness, and all those kinds of things. But Jeremy asks, how does that relate to the ways we need to unleash people when the rise of fascism takes a leap in the coming of the years? I really agree with Deborah and with what Coco was saying. We are looking at an overall system failure now. The defensive, the last dying mechanisms of popular defense under the rubric of bourgeois democracy seem to be fading. And I think if this happens the next time, when we get the next Trump administration, it's going to be a great illustration of the failure, of the last failure of those institutions, and the need to understand the struggle against fascism as a struggle against the society and the social formation and the capitalism and imperialism that gave rise to fascism in the first place. And to understand that fascism as the context is also part of the same system that is giving rise to ecocide, as a product and expression of the same exact system that gives rise to imperial war, that combined with ecocide has brought the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists midnight clock closer to doom than it's ever been. And to see how all of these things, and to oppose fascism as a symptom of a deeper and wider system that is literally canceling all prospects for a decent future on this planet. I think this next time we're going to have to more explicitly link the struggle against fascism to the demand for the radical reconstruction of society itself that Dr. Martin Luther King, near the end of his life, said was the real issue to be faced. And he said, if we don't do that, we're looking at a fascist police state. Believe it or not, King said that. King comes in for some excessive criticism sometimes from some of my comrades, and who I'd like sometimes want to look deeper at some of his late life stuff that he said from 67, 68 on and before he died. And I think we're going to have to unleash people against the whole system. I mean, what kind of goddamn society brings this stuff to the fore in the first place that pushes livable ecology to its very last limits and raises the question of extinction? That's my thought. We're going to really have to go bigger this time.
As we start to wrap up tonight, there was one question that I wanted to give as the last question. Some in the chat have already responded to this question, and I loved reading people's responses so far to it, but I wanted to pose it to you, Coco, and Paul as well. Lena, who had to put her little one to bed, had written, are there any other books, TV shows, films that people would recommend checking out now? So some folks already responded, keep responding, but I want to hear, Coco, Paul, is there anything that you've read recently or watched recently? I agree with Mort, El Dorado, really worth a watch. It's on Netflix. I encourage people to watch it when it came out on the pod. So I'd love to hear from you guys.
I put something in the chat. I guess I do recommend very strongly reading this article. It's called The Trials of Fascist Donald Trump and the Criminal Nature of This Whole System, or Don't Be Played by Four Suckers by Trump's Posturing, or The Democrats Posing as Defenders of Justice, We Need a Revolution and a Fundamentally Different and Far Better System by Bob Avakian. I'm recommending this just, you know, as myself, not as a member of the editorial board of Refuse Fascism. One thing that it's talking about is it's not just that Trump is openly racist. He even goes into this twisted logic that some people have that, oh, I'd rather vote for an open racist than a hidden racist. That's actually missing the point that Trump is actually a genocidal racist. But, you know, in the face of that, then what are the choices that we have? What is going to resolve this? I really do recommend digging into this article. I think it's really important. And I just want to say, I think this is true, that this is something Bob Avakian has said, radical change is coming of one form or another. We see this. But is it going to be radically emancipating or radically terrible? And right now, the trajectory we're on is radically terrible. And that is what we, in all kinds of ways, you know, even short of revolution, we have to change that trajectory. So I guess that's my recommendation. But, you know, I know there are a lot of other good things out there. And I will definitely take all of these recommendations to heart.
Well, you shouldn't ask an old history professor for a reading recommendation. Recently, I was looking again at William Shire's personal memoir. William Shire, the guy who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And he was there. He was present. He documented. He wrote about the rise of fascism in Germany. And he has a memoir called The Nightmare Years that are based on those that time in his life when he was watching Hitler rise to power. And I think one of the themes that keeps coming through again and again is the denial and the missed opportunities to have squelched this thing before it got so big that 50 million people died in World War II. I've actually also been reading the January 6th report. And the reason that that's just that the House Select Subcommittee put out, you don't have to read the whole damn thing. We can read the executive summary, which is long enough. It just blows my mind. I mean, they completely understood that there was a fascist coup underway years ago. And the notion that we're still litigating this thing all these years later, that they've dragged it out this long. It's just extraordinary. You can go online and see the Trump policy wonk document, Project 25. Just Google it up. You can read it as a PDF. It's horrifying, but it's important. You can see that this time through, there's a full, ongoing, multidimensional, right-wing Christian nationalist policy agenda. Now on more friendly kind of stuff that doesn't go hundreds and hundreds of pages, Jeff Charlotte's book, and I know that, Sam, you interviewed Jeff. It's a reader-friendly memoir, a road trip across the country, and Charlotte goes into these households of these really hardcore Trump backers, and you can have no mystery anymore about the really fundamentally, not in fascist, but even sort of genocidal nature of a lot of the Trump base after you've read this book. It's just very readable and very personable and very just very well done and poetically done. And the last book I'll mention is the wonderful, wonderful writer, a best-selling historian, Adam Hochschild's book, American Midnight. which is the story of internal dissent and racial repression in the United States during and right after World War One, during the so-called first Red Scare, which is really the country's second or third Red Scare. It's just a great antidote to those people who tell you it can't happen here. There really was a kind of rough draft leap into what really looks very much like fascism in this country between 1917 and 1921. And by the way, the president of the United States during that time was a so-called liberal Democrat named Woodrow Wilson. And it's just a very readable and very important historical study about all of that. That was long-winded, but I warned you.
No, it was great. I think people enjoyed it. And I love all these recommendations. I
want a second one. Yeah, yeah. The Prophet song, it just won the Booker Prize. And it sounds really timely and interesting. So I'm definitely going to read it.
That was just a taste of the meaningful conversation some of our wonderful patrons participated in. You can become part of this community and join events like this when you become a patron. Plus, you'll be supporting our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. We have no sponsors and count on you. So whether you can give $2 a month or $20 a month, it all makes a difference in producing and promoting this independent weekly podcast. Join today at patreon.com/refusefascism or by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button. Be sure to select recurring donation. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. We are getting ready for our 2023 Year in Review show, and we want to hear from you. What episodes did you find most informative, meaningful, inspiring? Why? Let us know. Reach me at the site previously known as Twitter at Sandy Goldman. Drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org. We're on Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, Mastodon at Refuse Fascism. So let us know there. Leave us a voicemail. See our show notes for the button. We'd love to hear from you. Of course, you can comment on YouTube if that's where you listen. And you can also find me now on TikTok for the show, where I'm sharing some content related to the pod at Sam Goldman RF. So find me there. And if you want to support the show, it's so simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can also literally put it on your forehead with our Refuse Fascism beanie. Make a gift of $35 or more to Refuse Fascism before January 1st, and you'll get two, one for yourself and one to gift. There are a few remaining, so be sure to do it quickly. Go to refusefascism.org and hit the donate button. Be sure to provide a shipping address so we can get it to you. Thanks to Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tingleman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each show. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox. We'll be off next Sunday, but we will have a special Year in Review episode, New Year's Eve, December 31st. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.